Thank you, Judge. Good morning to the judges of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Counsel. If it please the Court, my name is Rex Andrag, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Bernadine Matthews, in this particular case. This case is fundamentally about a contract between an employer and a former employee. And I believe that it's important not to forget in this case why this particular contract was consummated in the first place, because it resolved prior litigation between these parties, and this contract resulted in a dismissal of the employee's claims. This was in 2003. And whether or not those claims had been meritorious now turns out not to be as important as the fact that it put the employer on notice that, according to the employee, she had been out looking for a job, was trying to use her 19 years of experience with the employer as a reference, and the employer was telling people that she never worked for the employer. And so the contract that resolved this litigation, the same contract that this appeal is about, required WEC to respond to any request for a reference in a manner that was consistent with its policy for reference checks. And what I believe is important to remember, again, is that when the smoke cleared after this fall of 2003 with the execution of this contract, WEC could and did maintain that it had never failed to verify Ms. Matthews' employment, but it couldn't deny that it was aware of her claim that it was mishandling her employment requests.
Mr. Andrag, on the breach of contract claim, what are Ms. Matthews' damages with respect to FMS and Mr. Schwartz? Because neither was a potential employer, how was she harmed by the inaccurate information?
Well, first of all, I would answer that, Judge, by saying that I don't believe that in terms of whether or not the contract was to apply to only to prospective employers that it's necessary to get into the party's intent here, that the language itself was not ambiguous, and we know that because WEC's own attorney considered Howard Schwartz's inquiry to be a reference request. The question that you raise is a good one, and I would agree, at least in terms of damages is what I'm saying, and I would agree that Ms. Matthews had her work cut out for her in terms of proving damages, and to a degree would have to have relied on some reasonable inferences in terms of a lot of resumes that she sent out and no responses that she ever received. But I think the degree of damages is a question that is distinct from whether or not there was a breach. And I think there was a breach because I think the contract on its face and by its own language and by the attorney English's own admission applied to these types of reference requests. And unfortunately, when we talk about damages, a lot of attorney's fees, unfortunately, hung in the balance in this case. And I realize that there's allegations here on both sides that this case was largely about attorney's fees. And I can't speak for Attorney Hines, but I can certainly speak for Bernadine Matthews. And for her, this case was not about fees. It was about justice and getting WEC to do what it agreed to do. In terms of that the WEC agreed to adhere to its policy with regard to reference requests, I think begs the question, well, what was its policy? And a better question might be, was there a factual dispute about what the policy would have allowed? And I think the answer must be yes, that there was a factual issue here for the jury to resolve, because even WEC offered two competing different interpretations of its own policy. On the one hand, it said that it would provide dates of employment, the final salary, and the last position held. And this was what was referred to as the name, rank, and serial number approach at the hearing when the agreement was reached in 2003. And it was to prevent any disclosure of subjective information, I think to avoid any liability that could come with the disclosure of information that would be perhaps prejudicial to somebody looking for employment. But WEC also argued, I think with equal or if not more vigor, that it could provide information well beyond the dates employed and the salary and the position held, even negative information, as long as it was subjectively true. And so WEC...
Here, too, the question apparently was answered as to about the litigation history. That information was given in answer to a question.
I beg your pardon, Judge. Could you repeat that?
That information was given in answer to a question.
That information, which information are you referring to, the negative information?
The information about the litigation history between your client and the company.
Well, that, I believe, is one factual interpretation that I believe that WEC, you're correct, is maintaining that information was given out in response to some inquiries that were made by Howard Schwartz. There is a factual dispute about that, though, because I believe Howard Schwartz indicated that information was volunteered and that... when Ms. English, Attorney English, came on the phone, called him back to respond to the reference request, that she explained that she was calling because there was ongoing litigation between Ms. Matthews and the company. In fact, there had been previous litigation, and that she wanted to be very careful in terms of how she responded to this. And so I think whether or not it was volunteered or whether it was in as a part of her information that was requested, I think is a matter of factual dispute in this record.
Is that an area that in which you believe the in-house attorney should have done another sort of rank serial number response to?
Yes, if she was going to respond to be the individual who responded to the request, yes, that would have been a situation where I believe she should have got on the phone and said that Ms. Matthews worked for the company from 1980 until 1999, that she was a commercial service rep from 1983 until 1999.
In other words, your argument is that her bringing up any sort of litigation was gratuitous at best.
Yes.
And somewhat nefarious at worst.
That's correct, Your Honor, okay. And prejudicial.
Wasn't the litigation a matter of public record?
At that point in time, I can't say that it was. I imagine that it was.
Complaint had been filed, hadn't it?
I think it had been, and I think it may have been a matter of public record. But I think that the fact that it was a matter of public record is sort of perhaps, again, is an issue that could come into play when we're talking about damages. But certainly I think it's an issue that's irrelevant to whether or not the contract or the settlement agreement was being followed at that point in time. And so we do have this other interpretation of what the policy would allow, and that is that the policy would allow that negative information could be provided as long as it was objectively true, and that the policy would allow WEC to tell inquiring parties that Ms. Matthews had twice sued her employer, and it was free to make negative statements about her in any context that was unrelated to her employment with WEC. And so given the fact that we have these two different interpretations of the policy set forth by the defendant in this case, I think it's certainly reasonable to say that there is a factual dispute about what that policy would or would not allow.
How would you describe your client's wishes at the time she entered into this settlement agreement? What was her concern that brought about the settlement agreement?
I think her concern at the time that she entered into this agreement would have been, and this was in the December of 2003, would be that if in the future that she would go out and seek employment and use WEC as a reference request, that unlike what had just happened during the previous year, which resulted in this litigation, that if the prospective employer or somebody, I guess, who was looking to was helping her get employment would call. The WEC would say, yes, in fact, she worked here, and this is what she did, and this is how much she was making, and this was the position that she was working. I believe that was what she had intended to happen. And I think a jury here could conclude the policy under the facts of this record would have been to go through the four databases that they had, boom, 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 locate the employee, and then give out the dates of employment, the final salary, and the last position. Did WEC do that in this case? I think a jury concluded that no, because if they had followed that policy, they never would have reported that she didn't work for them in the first place. And I understand that there was a slight, that they're claiming that there was a slight delay in responding, and that's not inconsistent with their policy, but I think the real question is whether a jury could find that it was inconsistent, and that would have to consider the circumstances that WEC didn't say, hey, we'll have to check the fourth database and get back to you on that. They reported, no, she never worked here, and that they only found and confirmed her employment after she was pressed. And so they wouldn't be, they'd have to ask themselves the question, why did they have to be pressed? And they wouldn't be deciding this issue in a vacuum. There would be history between Matthews and WEC that would be taken into consideration. I think my rebuttal time is
rebuttal time is just about to start. Mr. Harlan? Thank you, Mr. Andrew.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Emory Harlan on behalf of Wisconsin Energy. We are respectfully requesting that this Court affirm Judge Stadtmiller's grant of summary judgment as well as his award of reasonable attorney's fees pursuant to the settlement agreement that was entered into between the parties. The first issue that I will address is the breach of contract claim. And want to start out by talking about some procedural issues that we certainly put in our brief and that we want to call the Court's attention to. One of the requests that the Ms. Matthews is relying upon in her papers relates to an outfit called EMS. And as we indicated in our briefs, Judge Stadtmiller indicated that there was no evidence in the record to support EMS ever getting in contact with the company and making a request for information with respect to Ms. Matthews, and basically did not consider that for purposes of ruling on the summary judgment motion. He deemed it to be inadmissible. And yet Ms. Matthews has not addressed that whatsoever in her brief. Same thing with Mr. Beaudry, who apparently is a friend of Ms. Matthews. Judge Stadtmiller deemed any so-called evidence related to Mr. Beaudry to be inadmissible. Ms. Matthews talked about that particular supposed request for information, but offered no basis to dispute Judge Stadtmiller's ruling on that, and certainly didn't argue that he abused his discretion in ruling that evidence inadmissible. There's also the issue of Midwest Airlines, which is a place that, according to the record, Ms. Matthews applied. Judge Stadtmiller deemed that to be inadmissible hearsay. She did challenge that ruling in response to our motion to strike. But did not make any of the arguments that she's presenting in her brief to this court in terms of various hearsay exceptions. And therefore, those arguments, our position is, would be waived here on appeal.
Mr. Harlan, can I start you out? First of all, don't you mean FMS when you say EMS?
No, there were two separate, at least Ms. Matthews maintains that there were two independent separate requests by one outfit called FMS and the other EMS.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
So basically, FMS is a company that basically Ms. Matthews paid
right.
to do the background check. EMS, okay. as it turns out, is basically the same entity as FMS.
Okay. Okay. My dictionary has a different definition of reference than your dictionary.
Okay.
In my dictionary, a reference is a statement usually written as to a person's character, abilities, etc. And the term is not limited to prospective employers. Now, my dictionary is, you know, paper and ink, and yours is from the Internet. So maybe that accounts, you know, for the difference. I don't know. Mine is the Webster's Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, RHR Press, 2001. In any case, using my definition, why wasn't there a breach of contract when FMS and Mr. Schwartz contacted WEC?
Well, I guess our initial position is that just if the court applies the ordinary meaning of the term reference to this situation, especially given the context in which this was entered, just looking at the contract, we think it's clear that it deals with a situation where a prospective employer is contacting Wisconsin Energy and seeking information on Ms. Matthews. And it's undisputed in the record that neither FMS or any of the other entities, with the exception of Midwest Airlines, which we don't think there's admissible evidence in the record for, none of those entities or individuals were prospective employers of Ms. Matthews.
Look, a request for a reference can come, of course, from a potential employer, but it can also come from a creditor or a company performing a security check. I find, you know, WC's view of what the word reference means to be narrow, almost beyond discussion. The language of the agreement is much broader than that.
Well, again,
it's that, you know, it's any. The word any in there. So I'm having a bit of a problem with that.
And again, I guess, Your Honor, if you felt that the definition was not clear and you needed to look for some other evidence outside the four corners of the agreement to place a meaning on it, we have in our brief referred to two pieces of evidence that we think perhaps put more illumination in terms of what was intended by the parties when the agreement was entered into. One is the statement of Ms. Matthews' counsel during the settlement conference where she basically said the concern was what Wisconsin Energy would say to prospective employers. And the second piece of evidence that we directed the court's attention to is Ms. Matthews' own declaration that she submitted in support of her motion for a preliminary injunction, where she, when trying to explain what her understanding of the agreement was, specifically said it was that if a prospective employer contacted the company for a reference, and that's what the agreement would apply to. So to the extent that there is any confusion, although our position is there isn't, if the court disagrees with us and feels the need to look external to the document to try to put some context into it, we think that supports our reading and definition of the term reference.
See, here's my problem. The language of the settlement agreement obliges WEC to respond to, quote, any request for a reference, end quote, in a manner consistent with their then current policy, and that policy was to give name, rank, and serial number. A WEC failed to confirm her employment at all on first inquiry from both FMS and Schwartz, and then misrepresented the title of her last position. In addition, The in-house counsel added all of this gratuitous damaging material, and there's no evidence that the policy allowed that or that this was the customary practice when references were requested. The brief kept characterizing the conduct of WEC in denying that Matthews worked for the company as a matter of a small delay. Now, did the company spontaneously correct itself after these errors, or did the corrections occur only after further inquiry?
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, with respect to FMS, the record, I think, is fairly clear that the initial response was, I can't locate her in the system, and then shortly thereafter, the individual, Mr. Banasek, who was responsible for responding to the information request, was able to locate her information and communicated that directly to the representative from FMS.
Okay, so in other words, the company did spontaneously correct itself.
Yes, Your Honor, and moreover, there's no evidence in the record that the company's policy has any particular time frame associated with it. Obviously, there's a concept of reasonableness, and to the extent that it took months, for instance, for them to get back to someone seeking a reference, that perhaps would be a violation, but there's absolutely no evidence in the record that there's a 24-hour turnaround or any particular time frame that was bargained for by Ms. Matthews. Presumably, if she wanted that kind of detail, she was represented by counsel, and she could have negotiated for that. With respect to Mr. Schwartz, there is nothing in the record to suggest that he was given erroneous information at all. They were, again, just to put this in context, because I think Your Honor asked about what was going on when Mr. Schwartz contacted the company. Keep in mind, the very case that we're here on had been filed by Ms. Matthews. I think it would almost be a dereliction of duty if an in-house labor counsel for a company that's being sued over the issue of what is being communicated did not involve herself and try to figure out what was going on.
But was it appropriate for her to give the information that she did give? I mean, she was a regular chatty Cathy with this Mr. Schwartz.
Well,
she should have known better.
Mr. Schwartz was seeking to engage her, and I think a fair reading of the evidence is that he was not really calling the company for purposes of advancing her interest in finding a position, certainly not a position with his company. And I think the evidence is, and what's in the record, is that Ms. English was trying to explain to him her involvement in the situation. And again, just to remind the court, at the time they had this conversation, Ms. Matthews had a lawsuit pending on this very case for about 3 or 4 months.
Why did she ask questions about the about Ms. Matthews' Social Security status?
Well, I think she was the way that the correspondence came into the company from Mr. Schwartz was very unusual. It was sent. It was end up faxed to the Vice President of Human Resources, which is something that doesn't happen. And obviously, I think the record provides that this is not something that the company is used to seeing, someone purporting to be an agent of the Social Security Administration calling up seeking information on someone who was a former employee, especially someone who's in the middle of litigation over the very issue.
What does the record show with respect to what kind of Social Security benefit Ms. Matthews was receiving?
I don't think the record is really clear, but I seem to recall from her deposition that she has some type of partial disability.
I see.
It wasn't a total disability situation. Under some nuance of the regulations, she was allowed to continue to work and still get benefits.
Mr. Harlan, you know, in the brief, you really didn't respond to the argument that she could not be characterized as a credit specialist, given that she never worked a single day in that job. Can you respond to her argument that the last position she actually held is the position of commercial service representative? And obviously, I'm looking for a focus on that word held.
Well, again, according to the company's records, and I think it's undisputed, there was a reclassification of a whole host of individuals, not just Ms. Matthews, who had been gone from the company for an appreciable amount of time, into this new category, and that is what was set forth on the company's records. And Judge Stadmiller found that there was really no issue about the fact that she was in the credit specialist position. I think it's also important for the court to note that she could have, to the extent she was maintaining this was causing her difficulty, she could have clarified that on her resume or in her CV so that it wasn't an issue. If I could just address one other point about the meaning of reference or how restricted Ms. Matthews is alleging the company was in responding to third-party inquiries, don't forget there's a second part of that reference section that talks about the company not being able to say that an employee was terminated, that she was terminated or fired. To try to make sense of all this, if her position is that you could never say anything beyond name, rank, and serial number, why do you need that second sentence? It would make no sense. It would just be wasted language.
I'm sorry,
well,
sir.
Well, it would be insurance, to me.
What second sentence?
I'm sorry, Yarn. If you look at the language relating to the reference, Section 17 of the settlement agreement, there is a second sentence that says, Wisconsin Gas will not respond to any request for a reference by indicating that Ms. Matthews was terminated or fired.
And if you could expand on that a little bit.
Okay. As I understand Ms. Matthews' contention relative to reference requests, it's essentially all the company could do when they got a reference request is basically give the dates of employment, last position held, and salary information. Well, if that's the case, what's the purpose of that second sentence?
Look, the information that was given out by the in-house counsel would have been devastating had the inquiry come from a prospective employer. That stuff about the, you know, her Social Security, you know, it really was gratuitous and a bit mean-spirited, it seems to me. I think that Ms. Matthews was very smart, given the history, to hire FMS to test the water. So, you know, I am having a bit of a problem.
Well, if I could just end by responding briefly, Your Honor, again, I would ask you to look at the context in which the statement was made. It was clear, according to the evidence and record, that when Ms. English was having the discussion with the representative, Mr. Schwartz, she knew he wasn't a prospective employer. There's no indication that this was being done for purposes of trying to harm Ms. Matthews' employment prospects.
Well,
she was simply putting context and giving an explanation in terms of why she was involving herself in the situation, and there's nothing that precludes that.
In actuality, he might very well have been more important to Ms. Matthews than one particular possible employer. He was a very important person for her in the scheme of things. And some of that, you know, and the agreement, you know, was still in place. And it sure sounds like breaches of that agreement, you know. But oh well. Okay. Thank you.
Huh?
I'll think about everything you said.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Harlan. Mr. Anderig?
Thank you. I'd like to respond just real briefly to the information that was said by Mr. Harlan regarding the reference requests to EMS, Mr. Beaudry, and some of the information about Midwest. I do want to acknowledge that the district court held that or ruled that the requests by EMS and Mr. Beaudry were not admissible. And I also do want to acknowledge that there is some difficulty with that Midwest express information, that Tressel Brown information, and the hearsay hurdle that we have to get over. But I do want to point out that even without that information, when you look at the prior lawsuit and what really culminated in this agreement in the first place, and we do have the situation revolving the reference request to FMS, and we do have the information regarding Mr. Schwartz's inquiries, and we do have the remarks by Attorney English, that there is still plenty of evidence without that other stuff from which a jury could still find a breach of the contract. I also want to respond to the questions that were that revolved around the actual requests that when they came into WEC. There's a factual dispute here about what was actually said. I heard Attorney Harlan characterize the response to the inquiries as, well, we're still looking, we haven't been able to find her. But there is also evidence in the record that the response was no, she never worked here. And so there's a factual dispute about that, as well as whether or not they spontaneously corrected the situation or only did so after they were pressed. The record can be characterized that it was a spontaneous correction, but there is also evidence from which a jury can infer that they did not spontaneously correct, that they only corrected when they were pressed. I also want to respond to Mr. Harlan's remarks that Attorney English did not provide any false information. I think that might be true, but she provided negative information under any definition of the word negative. And the question here is not whether the information she provided was false. The question here is whether the negative information and the responses that she provided were consistent with WEC's policy. And I don't believe that there's anything in the record that would suggest that that type of response was consistent with their policy. And that really is the ultimate question. We also, I don't think, need to get into what did the parties intend in terms of what type of entities this agreement was to apply to. Because the language is not ambiguous, we don't need to get into the party's intent. The language clearly states any request for a reference. And the fact that there's another sentence at the end of that which emphasizes the fact that they won't say that she was terminated or fired is not at all indicative. I don't think should be used to interpret that first sentence. I think that's just emphasizing probably the most important portion of how she wanted them to respond. And we really do need to go to the record to find out what the policy was. And I think that was name, rank, and serial number. That certainly was not followed in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andrade. Thank you, Mr. Harlan. The case is taken under advisement.